Chapter 30 Galaxy Down. In the wardroom, the sudden surge of full thrust came like a stay of execution. The horrified officers had seen the collapse of the chosen landing site and knew that there was only one way of escape. Now that Chang had taken it, they once more permitted themselves the luxury of breath. But how long they could continue to enjoy that experience, no one could guess. Only Chang knew whether the ship had enough propellant to reach a stable orbit. And even if it did, Captain Laplace thought gloomily, the lunatic with the gun might order him down again. Though he did not for a minute believe that she really was a lunatic. She knew exactly what she was doing. Suddenly, there was a change in thrust. "Number 4 motors just cut," said an engineering officer. "I'm not surprised. Probably overheated. Not rated for so long at this level." There was, of course, no sense of any directional change. The reduced thrust was still along the ship's axis, but the views on the monitor screens had tilted crazily. Galaxy was still ascending, but no longer vertically. She had become a ballistic missile aimed at some unknown target on Europa. Once more, the thrust dropped abruptly. Across the video monitors, the horizon became level again.
"He's cut the opposite motor. Only way to stop is cartwheeling. But can he maintain altitude? Good man."
The watching scientists could not see what was good about it. The view on the monitors had disappeared completely, obscured by a blinding white fog.
"He's dumping excess propellant, lightening the ship."
The thrust dwindled away to zero. The ship was in freefall. In a few seconds, it had dropped through the vast cloud of ice crystals created when its dumped propellant had exploded into space. And there beneath it, approaching at a leisurely 1/8 of a gravity acceleration, was Europa's central sea. At least Chang would not have to select a landing site. From now on, it would be standard operating procedure, familiar as a video game to millions who had never gone into space and never would. All you had to do was to balance the thrust against gravity so that the descending ship reached zero velocity at zero altitude. There was some margin for error, but not much, even for the water landings that the first American astronauts had preferred and that Chang was now reluctantly emulating. If he made a mistake, and after the last few hours he could scarcely be blamed, no home computer would say to him, "Sorry, you've crashed. Would you like to try again? Answer yes, no." Second Officer Yu and his two companions, waiting with their improvised weapons outside the locked door of the bridge, had perhaps been given the toughest assignment of all. They had no monitor screens to tell them what was happening and had to rely on messages from the wardroom. Nor had there been anything through the spy mic, which was hardly surprising. Chang and McMahon had very little time or need for conversation. The touchdown was superb, with hardly a jolt. Galaxy sank a few extra meters, then bobbed up again to float vertically and, thanks to the weight of the engines, in the upright position. It was then that the listeners heard the first intelligible sounds through the spy mic.
"You maniac, Rosie," said Chang's voice,
more in resigned exhaustion than anger.
"I hope you're satisfied. You've killed us all."
There was one pistol shot, then a long silence. Yu and his colleagues waited patiently, knowing that something was bound to happen soon. Then they heard the locking levers being unlatched and gripped the spanners and metal bars they were carrying. She might get one of them, but not all. The door swung open very slowly.
"Sorry," said Second Officer Chang. "I must have passed out for a minute."
Then, like any reasonable man, he fainted again. Chapter 31 The Sea of Galilee. "I can never understand how a man could become a doctor," Captain Laplace told himself. "Or an undertaker, for that matter. They have some nasty jobs to do."
"Well, did you find anything?"
"No, Skipper. Of course, I don't have the right sort of equipment. There are some implants that you could only locate through a microscope, or so I'm told.
They could only be very short range, though. Perhaps to a relay transmitter somewhere in the ship. Floyd suggested we make a search. You took fingerprints and... any other idents?
Yes. When we contact Ganymede, we'll beam them up with her papers. But I doubt if we'll ever know who Rosie was, or who she was acting for, or why, for God's sake.
At least she showed some human instincts, said Laplace thoughtfully. She must have known she'd failed when Chang pulled the abort lever. She could have shot him then, instead of letting him land.
Much good that will do us, I'm afraid. Let me tell you something that happened when Jenkins and I put the cadaver out through the refuse dump.
The doctor pursed his lips in a grimace of distaste.
You were right, of course. It was the only thing to do. Well, we didn't bother to attach any weights. It floated for a few minutes. We watched to see if it would clear the ship, and then...
The doctor seemed to be struggling for words. What, damn it?
Something came up out of the water. Like a parrot beak, but about 100 times bigger. It took Rosie with one snap and disappeared. We have some impressive company here. Even if we could breathe outside, I certainly wouldn't recommend swimming.
Bridge to captain, said the officer on duty. Big disturbance in the water. Camera 3, I'll give you the picture.
That's the thing I saw, cried the doctor.
He felt a sudden chill at the inevitable ominous thought. I hope it's not back for more. Suddenly a vast bulk broke through the surface of the ocean and arched into the sky. For a moment the whole monstrous shape was suspended between air and water. The familiar can be as shocking as the strange when it is in the wrong place. Both captain and doctor exclaimed simultaneously, "It's a shark!" There was just time to notice a few subtle differences, in addition to the monstrous parrot beak, before the giant crashed back into the sea. There was an extra pair of fins, and there appeared to be no gills. Nor were there any eyes, but on either side of the beak there were curious protuberances that might be some other sense organs.
"Convergent evolution, of course," said the doctor. "Same problems, same solutions on any planet. Look at Earth. Sharks, dolphins, ichthyosaurs. All oceanic predators must have the same basic design. That beak puzzles me, though."
"What's it doing now?" The creature had surfaced again, but now it was moving very slowly, as if exhausted after that one gigantic leap. In fact, it seemed to be in trouble, even in agony. It was beating its tail against the sea, without attempting to move in any definite direction. Suddenly, it vomited its last meal, turned belly up, and lay wallowing lifelessly in the gentle swell.
"Oh my God," whispered the captain, his voice full of revulsion. "I think I know what's happened." "Totally alien biochemistries," said the doctor. Even he seemed shaken by the sight. "Rosie's claimed one victim after all."
The Sea of Galilee was, of course, named after the man who had discovered Europa, as he in turn had been named after a much smaller sea on another world. It was a very young sea, being less than 50 years old, and like most newborn infants, it could be quite boisterous. Although the European atmosphere was still too thin to generate real hurricanes, a steady wind blew from the surrounding land toward the tropical zone at the point above which Lucifer was stationary. Here, at the point of perpetual noon, the water was continually boiling, though at a temperature, in this thin atmosphere, barely hot enough to make a good cup of tea. Luckily, the steamy, turbulent region immediately beneath Lucifer was 1,000 kilometers away. Galaxy had descended in a relatively calm area, less than 100 kilometers from the nearest land. At peak velocity, she could cover that distance in a fraction of a second. But now, as she drifted beneath the low-hanging clouds of Europa's permanent overcast, land seemed as far off as the remotest quasar. To make matters worse, if possible, the eternal offshore wind was taking her farther out to sea,
and even if she could manage to ground herself on some virgin beach of this new world, she might be no better off than she was now. But she would be more comfortable. Spaceships, though admirably watertight, are seldom seaworthy. Galaxy was floating in a vertical position, bobbing up and down with gentle but disturbing oscillations. Half the crew was already sick. Captain Laplace's first action, after he had been through the damage reports, was to appeal for anyone with experience in handling boats, of any size or shape. It seemed reasonable to suppose that among 30 astronautical engineers and space scientists, there should be a considerable amount of seafaring talent, and he immediately located 5 amateur sailors and even one professional, purser Frank Lee, who had started his career with the Sung shipping lines and then switched to space. Although pursers were more accustomed to handling accounting machines, often in Frank Lee's case a 200-year-old ivory abacus, than navigational instruments, they still had to pass exams in basic seamanship. Lee had never had a chance of testing his maritime skills. Now, almost 1 billion kilometers from the South China Sea, his time had come.
"We should flood the propellant tanks," he told the captain.
"Then we'll ride lower and won't be bobbing up and down so badly." It seemed foolish to let even more water into the ship, and the captain hesitated. "Suppose we run aground." No one made the obvious comment, "What difference will it make?" Without any serious discussion, it had been assumed that they would be better off on land, if they could ever reach it.
"We can always blow the tanks again. We'll have to do that anyway when we reach shore to get the ship into a horizontal position. Thank God we have power."
His voice trailed off. Everyone knew what he meant. Without the auxiliary reactor that was running the life support systems, they would all be dead within hours. Now, barring a breakdown, the ship could sustain them indefinitely. Ultimately, of course, they would starve. They had just had dramatic proof that there was no nourishment but only poison in the seas of Europa. At least they had made contact with Ganymede, so that the entire human race now knew their predicament. The best brains in the solar system would now be trying to save them. If they failed, the passengers and crew of Galaxy would have the consolation of dying in the full glare of publicity. Part 4. At the Waterhole. Chapter 32. Diversion. "The latest news," said Captain Smith to his assembled passengers, "is that Galaxy is afloat and in fairly good condition. One crew member, a woman steward, has been killed. We don't know the details, but everyone else is safe. The ship's systems are all working. There are a few leaks, but they've been controlled. Captain Laplace says there's no immediate danger, but the prevailing wind is driving them farther away from the mainland, toward the center of Dayside. That's not a serious problem. There are several large islands they're virtually certain to reach first. At the moment, they're 90 kilometers from the nearest land. They've seen some large marine animals, but they show no sign of hostility. Barring further accidents, they should be able to survive for several months until they run out of food, which, of course, is now being strictly rationed. But according to Captain Laplace, morale is still high. Now this is where we come in. If we return to Earth immediately, get refueled and refitted, we can reach Europa in a retrograde-powered orbit in 85 days. Universe is the only ship currently commissioned that can land there and take off again with a reasonable payload. The Ganymede shuttles may be able to drop supplies, but that's all, though it may make the difference between life and death. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, that our visit has been cut short, but I think you'll agree that we've shown you everything we promised, and I'm sure you'll approve of our new mission, even though the chances of success are, frankly, rather slim. That's all for the moment. Dr. Floyd, can I have a word with you?" As the others drifted slowly and thoughtfully from the main lounge, scene of so many less portentous briefings, The captain scanned a clipboard full of messages. There were still occasions when words printed on pieces of paper were the most convenient medium of communication, but even here, technology had made its mark. The sheets that the captain was reading were made of the indefinitely reusable multifax material that had done so much to reduce the load on the humble wastepaper basket. "Heywood," he said, now that the formalities were over, "as you can guess, the circuits are burning up, and there's a lot going on that I don't understand."
"Ditto," answered Floyd. "Anything from Chris yet?"
"No, but Ganymede's relayed your message. He should have had it by now. There's a priority override on private communications, as you can imagine. But of course your name overrode that."
"Thanks, Skipper. Anything I can do to help?"
"Not really. I'll let you know." It was almost the last time, for quite a while, that they would be on speaking terms with each other. Within a few hours, Dr. Heywood Floyd would become that crazy old fool, and the short-lived mutiny on the universe would have begun, led by the captain.
It was not actually Heywood Floyd's idea. He only wished it was. Second Officer Roy Jolson was Stars, the navigation officer. Floyd barely knew him by sight and had never had occasion to say more than good morning to him. Floyd was quite surprised, therefore, by the navigator's diffident knock on his cabin door. The astrogator was carrying a set of charts and seemed a little ill at ease. He could not be overawed by Floyd's presence. Everyone on board now took him for granted, so there must be some other reason.
"Dr. Floyd," he began, in a tone of such urgent anxiety that he reminded his listener of a salesman whose entire future depends on making the next deal. "I'd like your advice and assistance."
"Of course. But what can I do?" Jolson unrolled the chart showing the position of all the planets inside the orbit of Lucifer.
"Your old trick of coupling Leonov and Discovery to escape from Jupiter before it blew up gave me the idea."
"It wasn't mine. Walter Kernow thought of it."
"Oh, I never knew that.
Of course, we don't have another ship to boost us here, but we have something much better."
"What do you mean?" asked Floyd, completely baffled.
"Don't laugh. Why go back to Earth to take on propellant when Old Faithful is blasting out tons every second, a couple of hundred meters away? If we tapped that, we could get to Europa not in 3 months, but in 3 weeks."
The concept was so obvious, yet so daring that it took Floyd's breath away. He could see half a dozen objections instantly, but none of them seemed fatal.
"What does the captain think of the idea?"
"I've not told him. That's why I need your help. I'd like you to check my calculations, then put the idea to him. He'd turn me down, I'm quite certain, and I don't blame him. If I was captain, I think I would too."
There was a long silence in the little cabin. Then Heywood Floyd said slowly, "Let me give you all the reasons why it can't be done. Then you can tell me why I'm wrong." Second Officer Jolson knew his commander. Captain Smith had never heard such a crazy suggestion in his life. His objections were all well-founded and showed little, if any, trace of the notorious not-invented-here syndrome. "Oh, it would work in theory," he admitted. "But think of the practical problems, man. How would you get the stuff into the tanks?"
"I've talked to the engineers. We'd move the ship to the edge of the crater. It's quite safe to get within 50 meters. There's plumbing in the unfurnished section we can rip out. Then we'd run a line to Old Faithful and wait until he spouts. You know how reliable and well-behaved he is."
"But our pumps can't operate in a near vacuum."
"We don't need them. We can rely on the geyser's own efflux velocity to give us an input of at least 100 kilos a second. Old Faithful will do all the work."
"He'll just give ice crystals and steam, not liquid water."
"It will condense when it gets on board."
"You've really thought this out, haven't you?" said the captain with grudging admiration. But I just don't believe it. Is the water pure enough, for one thing? What about contaminants, especially carbon particles?
Floyd could not help smiling. Captain Smith was developing an obsession about soot. We can filter out large ones. The rest won't affect the reaction. Oh, yes. The hydrogen isotope ratio here looks better than for Earth. You may even get some extra thrust.
What do your colleagues think of the idea? If we head straight for Lucifer, it may be months before they can get home.
I've not spoken to them. But does it matter when so many lives are at stake? We may reach Galaxy 70 days ahead of schedule. 70 days! Think what could happen on Europa in that time.
I'm perfectly aware of the time factor, snapped the captain. That applies to us as well. We may not have provisions for such an extended trip.
Now he's straining at gnats, thought Floyd, and he must know that I know it. Better be tactful. An extra couple of weeks? I can't believe we have so narrow a margin. You've been feeding us too well anyway. Do some of us good to be on short rations for a while. The captain managed a frosty smile. You can tell that to Willis and Mihailovich. But I'm afraid the whole idea is insane. At least let us try it on the owners. I'd like to speak to Sir Lawrence.
I can't stop you, of course, said Captain Smith in a tone that suggested he wished he could. But I know exactly what he'll say.
He was quite wrong.
Sir Lawrence Sung had not placed a bet for 30 years. It was no longer in keeping with his august position in the world of commerce. But as a young man, he had often enjoyed a mild flutter at the Hong Kong racecourse before a puritanical administration had closed it in a fit of public morality. It was typical of life, Sir Lawrence sometimes thought wistfully, that when he could bet, he had no money. And now he couldn't, because the richest man in the world had to set a good example. And yet, as nobody knew better than he did, his whole business career had been one long gamble. He had done his utmost to control the odds by gathering the best information and listening to the experts his hunches told him would give the wisest advice. He had usually pulled out in time when they were wrong, but there had always been an element of risk. Now, as he read the memorandum from Haywood Floyd, he felt again the old thrill he had not known since he had watched the horses thundering round into the last lap. Here was a gamble indeed. Perhaps the last and greatest of his career, though he would never dare tell his board of directors, still less the Lady Jasmine. Bill, he said, what do you think? His son, steady and reliable, but lacking that vital spark that was perhaps no longer needed in this generation, gave him the answer he expected. The theory is quite sound. Universe can do it, on paper. But we've lost one ship. We'll be risking another. She's going to Jupiter. Lucifer, anyway.
Yes, but after a complete checkout in Earth orbit. And do you realize what this proposed direct mission will involve? She'll be smashing all speed records, doing over 1,000 kilometers a second at turnaround.
It was the worst thing he could possibly have said. Once again, the thunder of hooves sounded in his father's ears. But Sir Lawrence merely answered, "It won't do any harm for them to make some tests, though Captain Smith is fighting the idea tooth and nail. Even threatens to resign. Meanwhile, just check the position with Lloyd's. We may have to back down on the Galaxy claim." Especially, he might have added, if we're going to throw Universe onto the table as an even bigger chip. And he was worried about Captain Smith. Now that Laplace was stranded on Europa, Smith was the best commander he had left.
Chapter 33 Pit Stop
sloppiest job I've seen since I left college, grumbled the chief engineer. But it's the best we can do in the time. The makeshift pipeline stretched across 50 meters of dazzling, chemical-encrusted rock to the now quiescent vent of Old Faithful, where it ended in a rectangular, downward-pointing funnel. The sun had just risen over the hills, and already the ground had begun to tremble slightly as the geyser's subterranean, or subhalian, reservoirs felt the first touch of warmth. Watching from the observation lounge, Heywood Floyd could hardly believe that so much had happened in a mere 24 hours. First of all, the ship had split into two rival factions, one led by the captain, the other perforce headed by himself. They had been coldly polite to each other, and there had been no actual exchange of blows. But he had discovered that in certain quarters, he now rejoiced in the nickname of Suicide Floyd. It was not an honor that he particularly appreciated. Yet no one could find anything fundamentally wrong with the Floyd-Jolson maneuver. That name was also unfair. He had insisted that Jolson get all the credit, but no one had listened. And Mihailovich had said, "Aren't you prepared to share the blame?" The first test would be in 20 minutes, when Old Faithful rather belatedly greeted the dawn. But even if that worked, and the propellant tanks started to fill with sparkling pure water rather than the muddy slurry Captain Smith had predicted, the road to Europa was still not open. A minor, but not unimportant factor was the wishes of the distinguished passengers. They had expected to be home within 2 weeks. Now, to their surprise, and in some cases consternation, they were faced with the prospect of a dangerous mission halfway across the solar system. And even if it succeeded, no firm date for a return to Earth. Willis was distraught. All his schedules would be totally wrecked. He drifted around muttering about lawsuits, but no one expressed the slightest sympathy. Greenberg, on the other hand, was ecstatic. Now he would really be in the space business again. And Mihailovich, who spent a lot of time noisily composing in his far-from-soundproof cabin, was almost equally delighted. He was sure that the diversion would inspire him to new heights of creativity. Maggie M. was philosophical. "If it can save a lot of lives," she said, looking pointedly at Willis, "how can anyone possibly object?" As for Eva Merlin, Floyd made a special effort to explain matters to her, and discovered that she understood the situation remarkably well. And it was Eva, to his utter astonishment, who asked the question to which no one else seemed to have paid much attention. "Suppose the Europans don't want us to land, even to rescue our friends?" Floyd looked at her in frank amazement. Even now he still found it difficult to accept her as a real human being, and never knew when she would come out with some brilliant insight or utter stupidity. "That's a very good question, Eva. Believe me, I'm working on it." He was telling the truth. He could never lie to Eva Merlin. That, somehow, would be an act of sacrilege. The first wisps of vapor were appearing over the mouth of the geyser. They shot upward and away in their unnatural vacuum trajectories and evaporated swiftly in the fierce sunlight. Old Faithful coughed again and cleared its throat. A snowy white and surprisingly compact column of ice crystals and water droplets climbed swiftly toward the sky. All one's terrestrial instincts expected it to topple and fall, but of course it did not. It continued onward and upward, spreading only slightly until it merged into the vast, glowing envelope of the comet's still-expanding coma. Floyd noted with satisfaction that the pipeline was beginning to shake as fluid rushed into it. 10 minutes later, there was a council of war on the bridge. Captain Smith, still in a huff, acknowledged Floyd's presence with a slight nod. His number two, a little embarrassed, did all the talking. "Well, it works surprisingly well. At this rate, we can fill our tanks in 20 hours, though we may have to go out and anchor the pipe more securely." "What about the dirt?" someone asked. The second officer held up a transparent squeeze bulb holding a colorless liquid. "The filters got rid of everything down to a few microns.
To be on the safe side, we'll run through them twice, cycling from one tank to another. No swimming pool, I'm afraid, until we pass Mars. That got a much-needed laugh, and even the captain relaxed a little. We'll run up the engines at minimum thrust to check that there are no operational anomalies with Halley H2O. If there are, we'll forget the whole idea and head home on good old moon water, Fob Aristarchus. There was one of those party silences where everyone waits simultaneously for someone else to speak. Then Captain Smith broke the embarrassing hiatus. As you all know, he said, I'm very unhappy with the whole idea. In fact, he changed course abruptly. It was equally well known that he had considered sending Sir Lawrence his resignation, though in the circumstances that would have been a somewhat pointless gesture. But a couple of things have happened in the last few hours. The owner agrees with the project, if no fundamental objections emerge from our tests. And this is the big surprise, and I don't know any more about it than you do. The World Space Council has not only okayed, but requested that we make the diversion, underwriting any expenses incurred. Your guess is as good as mine. But I still have one worry. He looked doubtfully at the little bulb of water, which Heywood Floyd was now holding up to the light and shaking gently. I'm an engineer, not a damn chemist. This stuff looks clean, but what will it do to the tank linings? Floyd never quite understood why he acted as he did. Such rashness was completely uncharacteristic. Perhaps he was simply impatient with the whole debate and wanted to get on with the job, or perhaps he felt that the captain needed a little stiffening of the moral fiber. With one quick movement, he flicked open the stopcock and squirted approximately 20 cc of Halley's Comet down his throat. There's your answer, Captain, he said, when he had finished swallowing. And that, said the ship's doctor half an hour later, was one of the silliest exhibitions I've ever seen. Don't you know that there are cyanides and cyanogens and God knows what else in that stuff? Of course I do, Floyd laughed. I've seen the analyses. Just a few parts in a million, nothing to worry about. But I did have one surprise, he added ruefully. And what was that? If you could ship this stuff back to Earth, you could make a fortune selling it as Halley's patent purgative. Chapter 34 Car Wash. Now that they were committed, the whole atmosphere aboard Universe had changed. There was no more argument. Everyone was cooperating to the utmost, and very few people had much sleep for the next two rotations of the nucleus, 100 hours of Earth time. The first Halley day was devoted to a still rather cautious tapping of Old Faithful, but when the geyser subsided toward nightfall, the technique had been thoroughly mastered. More than 1,000 tons of water had been taken aboard. The next period of daylight would be ample for the rest. Heywood Floyd kept out of the captain's way, not wishing to press his luck. In any event, Smith had 1,000 details to attend to. But the calculation of the new orbit was not among them. That had been checked and rechecked on Earth. There was no doubt now that the concept was brilliant, and the savings even greater than Jolson had claimed. By refueling on Halley, Universe had eliminated the two major orbit changes involved in the rendezvous with Earth. She could now go straight to her goal under maximum acceleration, saving many weeks. Despite the possible risks, everyone now applauded the scheme. Well, almost everyone. On Earth, the swiftly organized Hands-Off Halley Society was indignant. Its members, a mere 236, but they knew how to drum up publicity, did not consider the rifling of a celestial body justified, even to save lives. They refused to be placated even when it was pointed out that Universe was merely borrowing material that the comet was about to lose anyway. It was, they argued, the principle of the thing. Their angry communiques gave much-needed light relief aboard Universe. Cautious as ever, Captain Smith ran the first low-powered tests with one of the attitude control thrusters. If this became unserviceable, the ship could manage without it. There were no anomalies. The engine behaved exactly as if it were running on the best distilled water from the lunar mines. Then he tested the central main engine, number one. If that was damaged, there would be no loss of maneuverability, only of total thrust. The ship would still be fully controllable, but with the four remaining outboards alone, peak acceleration would be down by 20%. Again, there were no problems. Even the skeptics started being polite to Haywood Floyd, and Second Officer Jolson was no longer a social outcast. The liftoff was scheduled late in the afternoon, just before Old Faithful was due to subside. Would it still be there to greet the next visitors in 76 years' time? Floyd wondered. Perhaps. There were hints of its existence even back on the 1910 photographs. There was no countdown, in the dramatic old-time Cape Canaveral style. When he was quite satisfied that everything was shipshape, Captain Smith applied a mere 5 tons of thrust on number one, and universe drifted slowly upward and away from the heart of the comet. The acceleration was modest, but the pyrotechnics were awe-inspiring, and to most of the watchers, wholly unexpected. Until now, the jets from the main engines had been virtually invisible, being formed entirely of highly ionized oxygen and hydrogen. Even when, hundreds of kilometers away, the gases had cooled off enough to combine chemically, there was still nothing to be seen because the reaction gave no light in the visible spectrum. But now, universe was climbing away from Halley on a column of incandescence too brilliant for the eye to look upon. It seemed almost a solid pillar of flame. Where the flame hit the ground, rock exploded upward and outward. As it departed forever, universe was carving its signature, like a piece of cosmic graffiti, across the nucleus of Halley's comet. Most of the passengers, accustomed to climbing spaceward with no visible means of support, reacted with considerable shock. Floyd waited for the inevitable explanation. One of his minor pleasures was catching Willis in some scientific error, but this very seldom happened. And even when it did, Willis always had some very plausible excuse.
"Carbon," he said. "Incandescent carbon, exactly as in a candle flame, but slightly hotter."
"Slightly," murmured Floyd.
"We're no longer burning, if you'll excuse the word."
Floyd shrugged his shoulders.
"Pure water. Although it's been carefully filtered, there's a lot of colloidal carbon in it, as well as compounds that could only be removed by distillation."
"It's very impressive, but I'm a little worried," said Greenberg. "All that radiation, won't it affect the engines and heat the ship badly?" It was a very good question, and it had caused some anxiety. Floyd waited for Willis to handle it, but that shrewd operator bounced the ball right back to him.
"I'd prefer Dr. Floyd to deal with that. After all, it was his idea."
"Jolson's, please. Good point, though. But it's no real problem. When we're under full thrust, all those fireworks will be 1,000 kilometers behind us. We won't have to worry about them." The ship was now hovering some 2 kilometers above the nucleus. Had it not been for the glare of the exhaust, the whole sunlit face of the tiny world would have been spread out beneath. At this altitude, or distance, the column of Old Faithful had broadened slightly. It looked, Floyd suddenly recalled, like one of the giant fountains ornamenting Lake Geneva. He had not seen them for 50 years, and wondered if they still played there. Captain Smith was testing the controls, slowly rotating the ship, then pitching and yawing it along the Y and Z axes. Everything seemed to be functioning perfectly. "Mission time zero is 10 minutes from now," he announced. "0.1 G for 50 hours, then 0.2 until turnaround, 150 hours from now." He paused to let that sink in. No other ship had ever attempted to maintain so high a continuous acceleration for so long. If Universe was not able to brake properly, she would also enter the history books as the first manned interstellar voyager. The ship was now turning toward the horizontal, if that word could be used in this almost gravityless environment, and was pointing directly to the white column of mist and ice crystals still steadily spurting from the comet. universe started to move toward it.
"What's he doing?" said Mihailovich anxiously.
Obviously anticipating such questions, the captain spoke again. He seemed to have completely recovered his good humor, and there was a hint of amusement in his voice.
"Just one little chore before we leave. Don't worry, I know exactly what I'm doing. And number two agrees with me, don't you?"
"Yes, sir. Though I thought you were joking at first."
"What is going on up on the bridge?" asked Willis, for once at a loss.
Now the ship was starting a slow roll, while still moving at no more than a good walking speed toward the geyser. From this distance, now less than 100 meters, it reminded Floyd still more closely of those far-off Geneva fountains.
"Surely he's not taking us into it."
But he was. Universe vibrated gently as it nuzzled its way into the rising column of foam. It was still rolling very slowly, as if it were drilling its way into the giant geyser. The video monitors and observation windows showed only a milky blankness. The whole operation could not have lasted more than 10 seconds. Then they were out on the other side. There was a brief burst of spontaneous clapping from the officers on the bridge, but the passengers, even including Floyd, still felt somewhat put upon.
"Now we're ready to go," said the captain, in tones of great satisfaction. "We have a nice, clean ship again."
During the next half hour, more than 10,000 amateur observers on Earth and Moon reported that the comet had doubled its brightness. The Comet Watch network broke down completely under the overload, and the professional astronomers were furious. But the public loved it, and a few days later, Universe put on an even better show, a few hours before dawn. Gaining speed by more than 10,000 kilometers an hour every hour, the ship was now far inside the orbit of Venus. It would get even closer to the Sun before it made its perihelion passage, far more swiftly than any natural celestial body, and headed out toward Lucifer. As it passed between Earth and Sun, the 1,000-kilometer tail of incandescent carbon was easily visible as a 4th-magnitude star, showing appreciable movement against the constellations of the morning sky in the course of a single hour. At the very beginning of its rescue mission, Universe would be seen by more human beings at the same moment than any artifact in the history of the world. Chapter 35. Adrift. The unexpected news that their sister ship Universe was on the way and might arrive far sooner than anyone had dared to dream had an effect upon the morale of Galaxy's crew that could only be called euphoric. The mere fact that they were drifting helplessly on a strange ocean, surrounded by unknown monsters, suddenly seemed of minor importance. As did the monsters themselves, though they made interesting appearances from time to time. The giant sharks were sighted occasionally, but never came near the ship, even when garbage was dumped overboard. This was quite surprising. It strongly suggested that the great beasts, unlike their terrestrial counterparts, had a good system of communication. Perhaps they were more closely allied to dolphins than to sharks. There were many schools of smaller fish which no one would have given a second glance in a market on Earth. After several attempts, one of the officers, a keen angler, managed to catch one with an unbaited hook. He never brought it in through the airlock. The captain would not have permitted it anyway, but measured and photographed it carefully before returning it to the sea. The proud sportsman had to pay a price for this trophy, however. The partial pressure spacesuit he had worn during the exercise had the characteristic rotten egg stink of hydrogen sulfide when he brought it back into the ship, and he became the butt of innumerable jokes. It was yet another reminder of an alien and implacably hostile biochemistry. Despite the pleas of the scientists, no further angling was allowed. They could watch and record, but not collect. And anyway, it was pointed out, they were planetary geologists, not naturalists. No one had thought of bringing formalin, which probably would not work here in any event. Once the ship drifted for several hours through floating mats or sheets of some bright green material, it formed ovals about 10 meters across and all of approximately the same size. Galaxy plowed through them without resistance, and they swiftly reformed behind her. It was guessed that they were colonial organisms of some kind. And one morning, the officer of the watch was startled when a periscope rose out of the water, and he found himself staring into a mild blue eye that, he said when he had recovered, looked like a sick cow's. It regarded him sadly for a few moments without much apparent interest, then slowly returned to the ocean. Nothing seemed to move very fast here, and the reason was obvious. This was still a low-energy world. There was none of the free oxygen that allowed the animals of Earth to live by a series of continuous explosions from the moment they started to breathe at birth. Only the shark of the first encounter had shown any sign of violent activity in its last dying spasm. Perhaps that was good news for men. Even if they were encumbered with spacesuits, there was probably nothing on Europa that could catch them, even if it wanted to. Captain Laplace found wry amusement in handing over the operation of his ship to the purser. He wondered if this situation was unique in the annals of space and sea. Not that there was a great deal that Mr. Lee could do. Galaxy was floating vertically, one-third out of the water, heeling slightly before a wind that was driving it at a steady 5 knots. There were only a few leaks below the waterline, easily handled. Equally important, the hull was still airtight. Although most of the navigation equipment was useless, they knew exactly where they were. Ganymede gave them an accurate fix on their emergency beacon every hour, and if Galaxy kept to her present course, she would make landfall on a large island within the next 3 days. If she missed that, she would head on out to the open sea and eventually reach the tepidly boiling zone immediately underneath Lucifer. Though not necessarily catastrophic, that was a most unattractive prospect. Acting Captain Lee spent much of his time thinking of ways to avoid it. Sails, even if he had suitable material and rigging, would make very little difference to their course. He had lowered improvised sea anchors down to 500 meters, looking for currents that might be useful, and finding none. Nor had he found the bottom. It lay unknown kilometers farther down. Perhaps that was just as well. It protected them from the submarine quakes that continually racked this new ocean. Sometimes Galaxy would shake as if struck by a giant hammer as a shockwave went racing by. In a few hours, a tsunami dozens of meters high would crash upon some European shore. But here in deep water, the deadly waves were little more than ripples. Several times, sudden vortexes were observed at a distance. They looked quite dangerous. Maelstroms that might even suck Galaxy down to unknown depths. But luckily, they were too far off to do more than make the ship spin around a few times in the water. And just once, a huge bubble of gas rose and burst only 100 meters away. It was most impressive, and everyone seconded the doctor's heartfelt comment, "Thank God we can't smell it." It is surprising how quickly the most bizarre situation can become routine. Within a few days, life aboard Galaxy had settled down to a steady routine, and Captain Laplace's main problem was keeping the crew occupied. There was nothing worse for morale than idleness, and he wondered how the skippers of the old windjammers had kept their men busy on those interminable voyages. They couldn't have spent all their time scrambling up the rigging or cleaning the decks. He had the opposite problem with the scientists. They were always proposing tests and experiments, which had to be carefully considered before they could be approved. And if he allowed it, they would have monopolized the ship's now very limited communications channels. The main antenna complex was now being battered around at the waterline, and Galaxy could no longer talk directly to Earth. Everything had to be relayed through Ganymede on a bandwidth of a few miserable megahertz. A single live video channel preempted everything else, and he had to resist the clamor of the terrestrial networks. Not that they would have a great deal to show their audiences except open sea, cramped ship interiors, and a crew that, though in good spirits, was becoming steadily more hirsute. An unusual amount of traffic seemed directed to Second Officer Floyd, whose encrypted responses were so brief that they could not have contained much information. Laplace finally decided to have a talk to the young man.
"Mr. Floyd," he said in the privacy of his cabin, "I'd appreciate it if you would enlighten me about your part-time occupation."
Floyd looked embarrassed and clutched at the table as the ship rocked slightly in a sudden gust.
"I wish I could, sir, but I'm not permitted."
"By whom, may I ask?"
"Frankly, I'm not sure."
That was perfectly true. He suspected it was Astropol, but the two quietly impressive gentlemen who had briefed him on Ganymede had unaccountably failed to provide this information. "As captain of this ship, especially in the present circumstances, I would like to know what's going on here. If we get out of this, I'm going to spend the next few years of my life at courts of inquiry, and you'll probably be doing the same."
Floyd managed a wry grin. "Hardly worth being rescued, is it, sir? All I know is that some high-level agency expected trouble on this mission, but didn't know what form it would take. I was just told to keep my eyes open. I'm afraid I didn't do much good, but I imagine I was the only qualified person they could get hold of in time."
"I don't think you can blame yourself. Who would have imagined that Rosie..." The captain paused, struck by a sudden thought. "Do you suspect anyone else?" He felt like adding, "Me, for instance," but the situation was already sufficiently paranoid. Floyd looked thoughtful, then apparently came to a decision.
"Perhaps I should have spoken to you before, sir, but I know how busy you've been.
I'm sure Dr. Vanderberg is involved somehow. He's a Mead, of course. They're odd people, and I don't really understand them." "Or like them," he might have added. "Too clannish, not really friendly to off-worlders. Still, one could hardly blame them. All pioneers trying to tame a new wilderness were probably much the same."
"Vanderberg.
What about the other scientists?"
"They've been checked, of course. All perfectly legitimate and nothing unusual about any of them."
That was not altogether true. Dr. Simpson had more wives than was strictly legal, at least at one time, and Dr. Higgins had a large collection of most curious books. Second Officer Floyd was not quite sure why he had been told all this. Perhaps his mentors merely wanted to impress him with their omniscience. He decided that working for Astropol, or whoever it was, had some entertaining fringe benefits.
"Very well," said the captain, dismissing the amateur agent.
"But please keep me informed if you discover anything, anything at all, that might affect the safety of the ship." In the present circumstances, it was hard to imagine what that might be. Any further hazards seemed slightly superfluous.
Chapter 36. The Alien Shore. Even 24 hours before they sighted the island, it was still not certain whether Galaxy would miss it and be blown on out into the emptiness of the Central Ocean. Her position, as observed by the Ganymede radar, was plotted on a large chart that everyone aboard examined anxiously several times a day. Even if the ship did reach land, her problems might be just beginning. She might be pounded to pieces on a rocky coast rather than gently deposited on some conveniently shelving beach. Acting Captain Lee was keenly aware of all these possibilities. He had once been shipwrecked himself, in a cabin cruiser whose engines had failed at a critical moment off the island of Bali. There had been little danger, though a good deal of drama, and he had no wish to repeat the experience, especially as there was no Coast Guard here to come to the rescue. There was a truly cosmic irony in their plight. Here they were, aboard one of the most advanced transportation devices ever made by man, capable of crossing the solar system. Yet now they could not deflect it more than a few meters from its course. Nevertheless, they were not completely helpless. Lee still had a few cards to play. On this sharply curving world, the island was only 5 kilometers away when they first sighted it. To Lee's great relief, There were none of the cliffs he had feared, nor, on the other hand, was there any sign of the beach he had hoped for. The geologists had warned him that he was a few million years too early to find sand here. The mills of Europa, grinding slowly, had not yet had time to do their work. As soon as it was certain they would hit the land, Lee gave orders to pump out Galaxy's main tanks, which he had deliberately flooded soon after touchdown. Then followed a very uncomfortable few hours, during which at least a quarter of the crew took no further interest in the proceedings. Galaxy rose higher and higher in the water, oscillating more and more wildly, then tumbled with a mighty splash to lie along the surface like the corpse of a whale in the bad old days when the catcher boats pumped them full of air to stop their sinking. When he saw how the ship was lying, Lee adjusted her buoyancy again until she was slightly stern down and the forward bridge was just clear of the water. As he expected, Galaxy then swung broadside on to the wind. Another quarter of the crew became incapacitated then, but Lee had enough helpers to get out the sea anchor he had prepared for this final act. It was merely an improvised raft made of empty boxes lashed together, but its drag caused the ship to point toward the approaching land. Now they could see that they were heading, with agonizing slowness, toward a narrow stretch of beach covered with small boulders. If they could not have sand, this was the best alternative. The bridge was already over the beach when Galaxy grounded, and Lee played his last card. He had made only a single test run, not daring to do more in case the abused machinery failed. For the last time, Galaxy extended her landing gear. There was a grinding and shuddering as the pads on the underside dug their way into the alien surface. Now she was securely anchored against the winds and waves of this tideless ocean. There was no doubt that Galaxy had found her final resting place, and all too possibly, that of her crew. Part 5. Through the Asteroids. Chapter 37. Star. And now universe was moving so swiftly that its orbit no longer even remotely resembled that of any natural object in the solar system. Mercury, closest to the sun, barely exceeds 50 kilometers a second at perihelion. Universe had reached twice that speed in the first day, and at only half the acceleration it would achieve when it was lighter by several thousand tons of water. For a few hours as they passed inside its orbit, Venus was the brightest of all heavenly bodies, next to the Sun and Lucifer. Its tiny disk was just visible to the naked eye, but even the ship's most powerful telescopes showed no markings whatever. Venus guarded her secrets as jealously as Europa. By going still closer to the Sun, well inside the orbit of Mercury, Universe was not merely taking a shortcut, but was also getting a free boost from the Sun's gravitational field. Because nature always balances her books, the Sun lost some velocity in the transaction, but the effect would not be measurable for a few thousand years. Captain Smith used the ship's perihelion passage to restore some of the prestige his foot-dragging had cost him. "Now you know," he said, "exactly why I flew the ship through Old Faithful. If we hadn't washed all that dirt off the hull, by this time we'd be badly overheating. In fact, I doubt if the thermal controls could have handled the load. It's already 10 times Earth level." Looking, through filters that were almost black, at the hideously swollen sun, his passengers could easily believe him. They were all more than happy when it had shrunk back to normal size, and continued to dwindle astern as Universe sliced across the orbit of Mars, outward bound on the final leg of its mission. The famous five had all adjusted, in their various ways, to the unexpected change in their lives. Mihailovich was composing copiously and noisily, and was seldom seen except when he emerged at meals, to tell outrageous stories and tease all available victims, especially Willis. Greenberg had elected himself, no one dissenting, an honorary crew member, and spent much of his time on the bridge. Maggie M. viewed the situation with rueful amusement. "Writers," she remarked, are always saying what a lot of work they could do if they were only in some place with no interruptions, no engagements. Lighthouses and prisons are their favorite examples. So I can't complain, except that my requests for research material keep getting delayed by high-priority messages. Even Victor Willis had now come to much the same conclusion. He too was busily at work on sundry long-range projects. And he had an additional reason to keep to his cabin. It would still be several weeks before he looked as if he had forgotten to shave. Eva Merlin spent hours every day in the entertainment center, catching up, as she readily explained, with her favorite classics. It was fortunate that Universe's library and projection facilities had been installed in time for the voyage. Though the collection was still relatively small, there was sufficient for several lifetimes of viewing. All the famous works of visual art were there, right back to the flickering dawn of the cinema. Eva knew most of them, and was happy to share her knowledge. Floyd, of course, enjoyed listening to her, because then she became alive, an ordinary human being, not an icon. He found it both sad and fascinating that only through an artificial universe of video images could she establish contact with the real world. One of the strangest experiences of Haywood Floyd's fairly eventful life was sitting in semi-darkness just behind Eva, somewhere outside the orbit of Mars, while they watched the original Gone with the Wind together. There were moments when he could see her famous profile silhouetted against that of Vivian Leigh and could compare the two, though it was impossible to say that one actress was better than the other. Both were sui generis. When the lights went up, he was astonished to see that Eva was crying. He took her hand and said tenderly, "I cried too when Bonnie died." Eva managed a faint smile. "I was really crying for Vivian," she said. "While we were shooting too, I read a lot about her. She had such a tragic life. And talking about her, right out here between the planets, reminds me of something that Larry said when he brought the poor thing back from Ceylon after her nervous breakdown. He told his friends, 'I've married a woman from outer space.'" Eva paused for a moment, and another tear trickled, rather theatrically, Floyd could not help thinking, down her cheek. "And here's something even stranger. She made her last movie exactly 100 years ago. And do you know what it was?" "Go on. Surprise me again." "I expect it will surprise Maggie, if she's really writing the book she keeps threatening us with. Vivian's very last film was Ship of Fools." Chapter 38. Icebergs of Space. Now that they had so much unexpected time on their hands, Captain Smith had finally agreed to give Victor Willis the long-delayed interview that was part of his contract. Victor himself had kept putting it off, owing to what Mihailovich persisted in calling his amputation. As it would be many months before he could regenerate his public image, he had finally decided to do the interview off-camera. The studio on Earth could fake him in later with library shots. They had been sitting in the captain's still only partly furnished cabin, enjoying one of the excellent wines that apparently made up much of Victor's baggage allowance. As Universe would cut its drive and start coasting within the next few hours, this would be the last opportunity for several days. Weightless wine, Victor maintained, was an abomination. He refused to put any of his precious vintages into plastic squeeze bulbs. "This is Victor Willis, aboard the spaceship Universe at 18:30 on Friday, 15 July 2061. Though we're not yet at the midpoint of our journey, we're already far beyond the orbit of Mars and have almost reached our maximum velocity. Which is, Captain?"
1,050 kilometers a second.
"More than 1,000 kilometers a second. Almost 4 million kilometers an hour."
Victor Willis' surprise sounded perfectly genuine. No one would have guessed that he knew the orbital parameters almost as well as did the captain.
But one of his strengths was his ability to put himself in the place of his viewers, and not only to anticipate their questions, but to arouse their interest. "That's right," the captain answered with quiet pride. "We are traveling twice as fast as any human being since the beginning of time." That should have been one of my lines, thought Victor. He did not like his subject to get ahead of him. But good professional that he was, he quickly adapted. He paused as if to consult his famous little memo pad, with its sharply directional screen whose display only he could see. "Every 12 seconds, we're traveling the diameter of Earth. Yet it will still take us another 10 days to reach Lucifer. That gives some idea of the scale of the solar system. Now, Captain, this is a delicate subject, but I've had a lot of questions about it during the last week." "Oh, no," groaned Smith. "Not the zero-gravity toilets again." "At this very moment, we are passing right through the heart of the asteroid belt." "I wish it was the toilets," thought Smith. "And though no spaceship has ever been seriously damaged by a collision, aren't we taking quite a risk? After all, there are literally millions of bodies, down to the size of beach balls, orbiting in this section of space, and only a few thousand have been charted." "More than a few, over 10,000. "But there are millions we don't know about." "That's true, but it wouldn't help us much if we did."
"What do you mean?"
"There's nothing we can do about them."
"Why not?"
Captain Smith paused for careful thought. Willis was right. This was indeed a delicate subject. Head office would rap his knuckles smartly if he said anything to discourage potential customers. "First of all, space is so enormous that even here, as you said, right in the heart of the asteroid belt, the chance of collision is infinitesimal. We've been hoping to show you an asteroid. The best we can do is Hanuman, a miserable 300 meters across, but the nearest we get to it is 250,000 kilometers.
"But Hanuman is gigantic compared to all the unknown debris that's floating round out here. Aren't you worried about that?"
"About as worried as you are at being struck by lightning on Earth."
"As a matter of fact, I once had a narrow escape on Pikes Peak in Colorado. The flash and the bang were simultaneous. But you admit that the danger does exist, and aren't we increasing the risk by the enormous speed we're traveling?"
Willis, of course, knew the answer perfectly well. Once again, he was putting himself in the place of his legions of unknown listeners on the planet that was getting 1,000 kilometers farther away with every passing second. "It's hard to explain without mathematics," said the captain. How many times he had used that phrase, even when it wasn't true. "But there's no simple relationship between speed and risk. To hit anything at spacecraft velocities would be catastrophic. If you're standing next to an atomic bomb when it goes off, it makes no difference whether it's in the kiloton or megaton class." That was not exactly a reassuring statement, but it was the best he could do. Before Willis could press the point further, he continued hastily. "And let me remind you that any slight extra risk we may be running is in the best of causes. A single hour may save lives."
"Yes, I'm sure we all appreciate that."
Willis paused. He thought of adding, "And of course I'm in the same boat," but decided against it. It might sound immodest, not that modesty had ever been his strong suit. And anyway, he could hardly make a virtue of a necessity. He had very little alternative now, unless he decided to walk home.
"All this," he continued, "brings me to another point. Do you know what happened just a century and a half ago on the North Atlantic?"
"In 1911?
"Well, actually, 1912.
Captain Smith guessed what was coming, refused to cooperate with a pretense of ignorance. "I suppose you mean the Titanic," he said.
"Precisely," answered Willis, gamely concealing his disappointment. "I've had at least 20 reminders from people who think they're the only one who's spotted the parallel."
"What parallel? The Titanic was running unacceptable risks, merely trying to break a record.
He almost added, and she didn't have enough lifeboats, but luckily checked himself in time when he recalled that the ship's one and only shuttle could carry not more than 5 passengers. If Willis took him up on that, it would involve altogether too many explanations.
Well, I grant that the analogy is far-fetched, but there's another striking parallel that everyone points out. Do you happen to know the name of Titanic's first and last captain?
I haven't the faintest, began Captain Smith. Then his jaw dropped.
Precisely, said Victor Willis, with a smile that it would be charitable to call smug.
Captain Smith would willingly have strangled all those amateur researchers, but he could hardly blame his parents for bequeathing him the commonest of English names.